People once believed that when someone dies, a crow carries their soul to the land of the dead. But sometimes, something so bad happens that a terrible sadness is carried with it, and the soul can't rest. Then sometimes, just sometimes, the crow can bring that soul back to put the wrong things right.
Goddamn creatures in the night, they never learn.
Suddenly, I heard a tapping, as of someone gently rapping at my chamber door. You heard me rapping, right?
Welcome to The Last Theater on the Left. My name is Chris.
My name is Joey.
And we're back, Joey.
What? Why are we back, Chris? It's October 30th. Right. Halloween isn't until manana.
Right. And if you are a like-minded individual, like the two of us in this room, then you will recognize that line from the movie we are talking about today. We are talking about The Crow. It is Devil's Night. It is the night before Halloween. And that's when I try to watch The Crow, at least on this night, every year. It is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's probably the movie I've watched more than any other movie in my entire life.
That goes my first question right there. And I got to tell you, the first time I met this guy and talked to him, I swear you were probably wearing a Crow t-shirt.
Probably, yeah. I still have it. I think I'm going to try to dig it out and I may wear it tomorrow.
Nice.
All day. I don't think I saw this movie in the theater, actually.
We did. We saw it in the now late Movies 8 in North Richland Hills at the Dollar Theater. I remember distinctly going to see that with you. Yeah,
because I didn't see it in the initial run, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
We saw it in the Dollar Theater.
Exactly. That's right. Why I'm here.
Thank you for back.
Yeah, we went out on a date. And now, for all intents and purposes, it kind of was. But that's what happens in high school, you know?
Right. I've been wanting to talk about this movie for ages. I love this movie. I have a lot to say about it. Hopefully it all comes across well. This isn't necessarily going to be like a review of the movie. Sort of is. It's just more of a discussion. It's kind of me talking to you and with you, Joey, yes, and the people listening about this movie that means a lot to me. Because as you may have kind of gathered from some of these conversations, I'm a huge comic book guy too. And not just the superhero comics, but also like the more underground independent comics, which is what this started as. And I actually got into the Crow comic book from the movie. I saw the movie before I had read the comic.
Gotcha.
But as talking about The Last Theater on the Left, up to this point, it's all been like horror movies and stuff. But like I said, this is also about cult movies and all these other movies that don't get as much recognition. And I think The Crow definitely does fit into that.
It's once again a like-minded thing.
Yeah,
if you dig horror movies and cool cult movies, you definitely dig The Crow. I can't imagine there's a lot of people who don't.
And it got covered in things like Fangoria and like horror movie magazines. And to this day, it still gets covered in
a lot of mainstream press too, for all the wrong reasons, unfortunately.
Well, but I mean, it fits into that genre of if you go to a horror convention, you're likely to see something about The Crow there as well, even though it's not a horror movie.
Figures, t-shirts, posters. Yeah. Now, you were talking about comics earlier, Chris. Yes. For someone like me, I'm the voice of the non-comic fan who respects the journey.
Sure.
So, my initial reaction to watching The Crow and all subsequent viewings, and I really noticed it a lot this time because I was trying to think of some deep subtext to talk about. I usually leave that to you, of course. But now, vigilante and superhero in the sense that he does have the power.
Yeah.
Unlike Batman, who I consider to be a vigilante and not a superhero, he's a hero, not a superhero,
right,
but a vigilante. I can talk around this conversation.
Right.
To me, I see like the parts that people look up to about Batman, and also a lot of the Joker, for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
Is that an intended thing on the creator's behalf? Was that a thing, or is it just in my head?
In the comic book, not so much. In the movie, it was a choice made by the director Alex Proyas and Brandon Lee, who had a lot of creative input in the movie.
Yeah, because up until that point, really the only successful recent comic book movie was Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah, it was a few years prior to that.
Yeah, or in subsequent sequels. Yeah. So. But that's probably why. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, totally. So when they were making this movie, aware that this was a comic book and they wanted to stay true to what the comic was, listening to the director's commentary by Alex Porteous on the Blu-ray, which is actually a different commentary than what's on the collector's edition DVD version.
Wow, which one's better?
The new one, the Blu-ray.
Okay.
So yeah, if you had to pick one, okay. Of course I'm going to keep both.
But. Sure. Yeah.
But Brendan Lee is playing the character of Eric Draven in this movie, who is a man who comes back from the dead to avenge his murder and mostly the murder of his fiance.
Yeah. And for you youngsters out there, Bruce Lee's son.
Yes.
That's important.
Yeah, it really is. And we'll get into a little bit more about that later.
Yeah.
So the comic book connections, like the jacket that he wears, the long jacket, when they were coming up with the style of the character of Eric Draven for the movie, they wanted something to kind of pay homage, I guess, to that comic book aspect of it. And so the flowing black coat is kind of like Batman's cape, Alex Porteous had said. So there's that little bit of connection there to it. But at the same time, Brandon Lee himself was saying, and Alex Porteous and the creator of the comic book itself, James O'Barr, is like, Eric's not a hero. That's not his purpose. He's killing bad guys, but he's not doing that for some altruistic purpose. He's doing this for revenge.
Yeah.
If people are helped by this, then that's good, but that's not his intention. That's not his goal.
Yeah, at the same time, he's making the city a better place.
Yeah.
But it's all, you know, it's bonus. It's icing. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that's really interesting. And that I would credit The Crow, the movie, and the comic into getting me into stuff like that. Because I was into, like, Spider-Man and stuff like that. And I was into The Punisher a little bit at the same time, too, which kind of has a similar thing to The Crow in that he's...
Yeah, for sure.
He's doing things from a self-centered purpose.
Yeah.
And he's helping people by chance or by happenstance.
Right, but this broke you out of the Marvel DC world.
Yeah. And I started getting other comics and more independent stuff as well.
Take a chance.
Yeah.
The same way that Tarantino got me to start watching independent films in my local video store. I started to take more chances.
Yeah.
Roll the dice. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. But I'm glad it happened. So O'Barr wanting to do, am I wrong that he wanted to do a hybrid of Batman and the Joker? Or you said that was more of a choice of Porteous.
That was more of a choice of Porteous.
Okay.
Because, like, from James O'Barr's perspective, what he was doing was catharsis. Because The Crow, the comic book, was very, very personal to him. This was him getting out his emotions. Because if you don't know the backstory to that...
I don't, yeah. Give me the Reader's Digest version. Yeah.
Basically, James O'Barr was to get married, and his fiance was killed in a hit and run. And it messed him up pretty bad, as you would expect. And I think he spent time in the military or something, but he did everything. He wrote it and he drew it and everything else. He didn't self-publish, but it was one of those really small indie things.
Yeah.
And he would just put out a little bit at a time, and this was him trying to get that out and get it on, like, for him to deal with that grief and that pain.
Yeah. Job well done, sir.
Yeah. And so that's why for the character of Eric and for James O'Barr, the creator of that character, it's not about a superhero. It's not about being this hero for the good of the world.
Yeah.
It's about, this hurts a lot. The only way I know how to deal with this is to hurt these other people that made me hurt so bad.
Yeah, it's more of, this world is terrible.
And it's like the thing, like, in the real world, there isn't that justice. When something like that happens, the hit and run people, I don't think anybody, no one was ever caught for that, from what I remember.
Yeah, it's
reading.
Not like today, where it could easily be caught. Like
right.
Some, you know, red light cams, DNA, you know, those weren't things at the time, I can imagine.
Yeah, and so, for Eric to actually be able to track these people down and to give them the justice that they deserved and then return back to from whence he came, so to speak.
True catharsis through art, that is something else, man. Wow.
And it's interesting, like, since we're talking about the comic, I think it's a good journey to start with the comic
and get into
the movie a little
bit. Origin story, just like any good comic.
Yeah, but I think it bleeds into the movie as well, because Brandon and Alex did try to make the movie feel like the comic, even though it's not necessarily the same story as the comic. And it really isn't, because the comic is very lyrical in a way. It's in the movie, there's the whole story of, this is the reason that Eric is back and he learns this, and there's the hierarchy of the bad guys, and there's that whole cycle, the narrative, that's very clean.
Yeah.
But in the comic, the first time you see Eric, he knows exactly what he wants to do. It's more just pieces of it.
They flash back here and there, I'm assuming. Yeah, okay. Yeah. All
right. So he already has this purpose, and really the comic, there's no upper guy. It's just there's these guys, he goes out, he kills them, and then he goes back to the grave, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, I read that tonight, actually, in preparation. I always hit the IMDb trivia track. Yeah. This is a Top Dollar was just one of the gang. Of
them, yeah. He was, like, to me, the way that T-Bird is in the movie,
yeah,
he feels like Top Dollar was in the comic. He's a little bit higher than the other ones, but he's just one of the other ones that gets killed.
Obviously a Hollywood decision. Yeah. You have to have a big bad.
And it makes sense because they're different mediums. Like, in comics, you can have this more lyrical... It's creating emotions and pictures and words. It's like a poem, as opposed to in a movie, you kind of need a narrative if you're going to want to sell it to theaters and people more than like 100 people to watch it.
You have to give her point A to point B.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So James O'Barr was trying to get out his emotions with this. And so the comic book came from his mind. And while he was writing and drawing The Crow, he was really into the underground music scene. Mm-hmm. And if you read the comic books, I think you'd actually like it a lot.
Okay.
Because there's a lot of lyrics from like underground artists and things like that. The character model of Eric is based on Peter Murphy from Bauhaus.
Nice.
Yeah.
When the cop character is named after the guy from Joy Division, I think, or something like
Albrecht?
That. Albrecht? Yeah.
Is he?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He was really into Joy Division, too, at the time. So that all kind of bleeds through, and it bleeds into the movie as well. The movements of Eric in the comic book, the way he's posing everything, a lot of that was based on the way Iggy Pop moves when he's performing, and you can see that.
Yeah, I heard his body type was modeled after him. Yeah. I did read that. Hopefully a little bit of Alice Cooper. If not, that's way too coincidental.
You can argue that. Like, everything I read, like, they point that out.
Right.
And they say most fans think it's like Alice Cooper or something. Yeah. But, I mean, it's based on the masks, the irony, and the...
Sure.
And that's kind of...
Yeah, that theater mask you see.
Yeah, it's the more emotional symbol of what it is.
Gotcha. Know? Yeah, because that mask precedes everything, so which comes first.
And because it's the smiling mask, and he has to paint the smile on his face because there's no joy left in his face. Yeah.
I just want everybody to be an Alice Cooper fan.
Right. It all comes through there. And then, of course, in the sequel, Iggy Pop is actually in the sequel, so that kind of comes full circle there.
Which is the only good thing about the movie, although he's terrible in it.
Yeah.
I love Iggy, but man, that's not some of the worst acting quite north of Lyle Lovett, for sure. Wow.
Yeah, it's not so good. I think there's actually a picture of Iggy Pop in this Crow, though. When they're going into the club, Trash, when they're walking by and you see T-Bird kind of brush his hand across the picture of Eric in his band.
Yeah.
To the right of it, I believe that's a picture of Iggy Pop on the wall.
Oh, like a promotional photo.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. I'll have to go back and look at that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's correct. I just actually saw that when I was watching the Blu-ray recently.
Yeah, and talking about these movies and breaking them down, there's all these little Easter eggs, and apparently this has been going on forever in movies, and I just never was keyed into it. Like finding out that James O'Barr, he cameos as a looter, the guy that's... taking a television out of the pawn shop when it blows up.
Yeah, you can see him. He actually looks kind of towards the camera, because that's the point of view of the officer, the police officer, Officer Albrecht, played by Ernie Hudson, who I love in this movie and everything else.
The third cop that he played that calendar year.
Oh, really?
He played three cops in 1994.
Yeah.
This? Can you name the other two?
I cannot, no.
You can name at least one, right?
Airheads.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. All right.
And one that I remember renting, The Cowboy Way. I looked it up.
Oh, okay.
Because those are the three Ernie Hudson cop movies I remember. And coincidentally, all from 1994.
Okay. I didn't realize that. Yeah.
Typecast much.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
He took over the cop hat after Ed O'Neill kind of hung it up for a little bit. So anyway, continue.
Yeah. Yeah. So I kind of leave the comic book because we're not talking about the comic book. We're talking about the movie. So it is changed around a lot. The only scene that really feels almost beat for beat like the comic book is the scene in Gideon's pawn shop.
That's
almost exactly. Even the quote from the Raven that he says when he's walking in, that's in there.
That's probably one of my favorite scenes in the whole film.
Yeah, it's really, I love it.
Yeah.
And the way, like, even the line when he leaves, so the last line he says, is that gasoline I smell?
Yeah.
That's in the comic, too.
Nice.
He blows it up. And so, yeah, that's almost exactly the same.
That's super cool, man. Great. Once again, great scene.
I guess kind of pivoting off of the comic book and talking about the movie, one of the conscious decisions of Alex Proyas was to make it look a bit like a comic book. And part of that was by necessity, but part of it was to try to pay tribute to that. Part of that is in the color palette of the movie. It's very bleak, very dark. It's almost black and white.
Oh my, yeah.
The movie is almost completely black and white.
I heard he wanted it to be put out that way.
And there's actually, if it was made today, like Mad Max, they did that black and white version of that. Logan, they did the Logan Noir. Yeah. So if it was released today, I'm sure they would have done it, at least for like the Blu-ray release.
Sure, yeah. I mean, it's not too late, right?
Yeah. But see, it's a little weird because, like, shooting in black and white is different than shooting a color movie than turning it black and white. Because when you shoot in black and white, you dress the set differently and you light it differently. So
you even wear different clothes.
Yeah. So it's not the same as just bleaching out all the color. It's still kind of cool.
Sure.
But that's why I've seen the Mad Max one. I haven't seen the Logan one. But it would be different if they had intended it for it to be black and white.
Gotcha.
But so, like, the colors in this movie are black, white, and red. There's a lot of red in the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
And
there's a river of one after a while.
Part of it's the blood, but that also kind of relates. I mean, that's intentional because that relates to the blood of the incident when he gets attacked and his fiance gets raped and murdered, and there's the blood. And so, if you notice the flashbacks, they're mostly all lit in red.
Yeah.
And they're very bright. And
yeah, you're right.
Some of the happier moments, even a lot of those are lit in red as well. There's one shot where they're in a field together. Eric and Shelley are in the field, and it's like orange, like the whole sky is orange and everything. But mostly it's red because when he kind of remembers his past, it's kind of tinged with that.
Well, it's a fit of rage, almost in a sense, is what I kind of get out of
it.
Like, it's a happy moment, but at the same time...
But it's colored with red because it's colored with blood, because he can't think about that without thinking about how it ended and why he's on this planet at this point.
And by doing that, it almost makes the movie feel like a black and white movie. So he kind of got a black and white movie in a way.
He did.
By doing that. It's a good choice.
And the way that they shot the movie, I thought was really interesting when watching, again, the commentary, which if you're a fan of this movie at all, I'd suggest watching it with the commentary, with the Alex Boris commentary, because he said that at times they would shoot the movie with like an orange filter on the screen, and then they would decolorize it. They would take the orange out, and that kind of bleached all the colors. So any color that was even still on there, it would reduce those even further.
Wow.
So it's that kind of thing. They didn't have a lot of money for this movie, but they made everything that they had work in really great ways.
I think one of the quotes was it was under 20 mil.
Yeah.
Like somebody that was like some disgruntled worker on the set was quoted as saying there was a lot of penny pinching here, like filming in North Carolina, which is an unprotected state.
Yeah.
They said that they're trying to make a $30 million movie with $18 million.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and they were. I mean, this is a comic book movie and there's a lot of action in it. There's a lot of stunts. There aren't a ton of like computer effects because this was still kind of early.
I only noticed at the very beginning with the fires. Really a whole lot?
That's actually not a computer effect.
Is that really not?
Yeah, because...
Wow. Is it minis?
It was all the wide sets.
Yeah.
Like when you see the city, anything above like that, it's all miniature. And he said that he actually put screens into the miniature and they projected flames onto the screens and that's how they shot those.
Huh.
Some of the computer effects that I can still see are like when Brandon's running across the rooftops. You can kind of tell that looks a little bit... Some of the effects are a little bit dated
in places
like that. And
but also at the same time, this film was way ahead of its time with like basically an early version of CG, if not CG.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, how else do they make this movie happen? How else is it finished?
Yeah.
They had to like... Didn't they have to like go out of the company basically? And someone else had to finish this film. And like I read that a whole entire company was created just to do that. So all the effects came from... This wasn't the original studio's doing. Yeah. Yeah. They actually, like, the studio, and forgive me, I don't remember which one, whoever financed it actually basically wrote it off afterwards. Yeah. And it had to get picked up and finished. And then Miramax put it out. They were not the original studio that
I remember the original release was Dimension.
Okay.
But I'm not sure who like financed it prior to that.
But I know it was dumped and picked up by Miramax and I don't know if they're the ones that put up the money, but I do know just in going through some of the trivia tracks and some of the articles I've read over the years is that you know, they hired this basically like effects studio to help finish this movie and make it look the way it wound up looking. Yeah. Not as far as the cinematography goes,
sure,
but as far as how you fill in the blanks of the Brandon Lee situation,
yeah,
which we should probably talk about
real quick. Yeah, we can go ahead and talk about that. I don't want to... The movie is not about Brandon Lee's death, and I think that that's what a lot of the attention goes to, and I think we should just get it out of the way.
Yeah.
I don't really want to talk about that so much, but I think...
But we have to talk about it for this other reason.
Yeah.
Not the sexy, you know, Inquirer version, but like the nuts and bolts of another reason what makes this such a great movie is how the hell they finished it.
Yeah, because this is Brandon's movie. It always was Brandon's movie because he was so involved with the creative side of it. And he really took this character and made it his own and he inhabited it. So this has always been Brandon's movie. And then, of course, he was killed on set. And they had filmed most of his scenes, but there were certain areas where they hadn't gotten anything or had barely gotten anything. And most of it has to do with any scene within Eric and Shelley's apartment. They didn't get a lot of that.
Yeah.
They got some of it, but they didn't finish nearly all of it.
Yeah. You need that for the background to get it over with the people.
Yeah.
People like me that don't know anything about the story. I mean, all these scenes are super crucial.
Yeah, because it's a lot of the connections to Shelley and the connection to Sarah. Like that big scene late in the movie where Sarah has, she's already seen Eric on the street and she realizes it's him because he says the song lyric that she recognizes. And she goes back to the apartment. They hadn't shot that yet, so they had to do this entire scene with just this girl who had never acted before in her life.
Yeah.
And she, her friend, like they became friends on set, has been killed and he's not there, and so she has to carry this entire scene.
Yeah, you told me before we recorded that she pretty much stopped acting because of this.
I've read things where it messed her up a little bit because she was, like I said, this was her first movie, and Brandon apparently was like the kind of guy who befriended everyone. Like
he seems that way.
Yeah, he was kind of a mentor to her a little bit because he was in some scenes with her and he helped her with her acting and helped her be comfortable, and they became friends on set. But yeah, so when they have to do this scene with just her
and a body double,
a body double for a little bit, but
she's got to be emotional towards this body double who's a stranger to her now.
But it does change the way that those scenes play out.
Yeah,
because instead of having the focus be on both characters and that connection, it's focused just on her. So I think, in a way, it makes it maybe emotionally a little bit stronger that's mostly because of her performance. If she hadn't been able to
get that out
of her, or if the director hadn't been able to help get that out of her, then it would have kind of fallen flat.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the heart of the movie there, because without as much footage of Eric and Shelley together in the flashbacks, Sarah is really the heart of the movie, that connection that he makes. That's Eric's connection to the living world, really.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I really like the way that scene plays out,
actually,
because it makes sense that Eric would hide himself. That's part of the reason why he wears the makeup.
Yeah, so that's why it doesn't seem so phony.
Yeah.
And this is the first time I've seen this movie knowing that fact.
Oh, really?
That he was not there.
Yeah.
And I watched it, I was like, man, that is so well done.
Yeah.
Also because of the fact that I never thought about it before. All those scenes, it's the first time I knew about any of this. Show me some shots in the book you have the actual book, like on the making of the movie, how they did it without him for the rest of the way, showing how they used the like early CG, basically early computer graphics. Like, man, that's not him putting the makeup on.
Right.
That's crazy.
He's not in that scene.
Yeah.
So that's the other main scene that they had to get that he wasn't there for, and of course that was in the apartment. So what they did there is the scene right before that, when he just gets out of the grave and he's walking like shirtless through the alleyway.
Yeah.
He's shivering, he's cold. It looks so cold in this movie, like all the time.
This is like the top 10 rain movies of all time.
But they took footage from that and they used that when they needed to show his face. Like when he first walks in the door, there's a little clip of him walking through the door and it's really dark.
Yeah.
So that's CG. And then most of it, you can tell if you're watching for it, you can tell that it could be him or it might not be because they don't show his face.
He has to do a frame by frame.
Yeah. Probably. When he punches the mirror when he sees his own face.
And is then, that a cover-up? I guess that is. Oh, geez. Yeah. Okay, all right.
And so when they do show a shot in the mirror, in the broken mirror, and you see Eric kind of shiver and kind of hunch over a little bit, and it's obviously Brandon in the mirror, okay. that's all CG. They took a shot from the alleyway, and there was a double for the movement of the body,
right?
And they CG'd him into that shot. And that's seamless. Like I had said, some of the effects don't necessarily hold up as well.
Yeah.
But those do, because I didn't, until I had read the book, I didn't know that.
Ah, man.
So talking about how him not being there changes those scenes, though, like it's amazing how they were able to make those scenes work without him. And if you didn't know, you wouldn't know.
Yeah.
But also, I think it works from a perspective of the story and the character. Because if Eric looks in the mirror and he punches the mirror because he sees himself, it makes sense that the director wouldn't want to show his face in the apartment. Yeah. Because Eric doesn't want to be there. That's the last place that he was happy with his fiance, and that's the worst place in his life.
Yeah.
And well, so
he's got to store up his camel hate hump, you know, like, yeah. I mean, that's what he's doing.
Yeah, but so like from the director's perspective, though, if I was making the movie as well, hopefully I would think of this because he doesn't want to be there, so the director doesn't show his face.
Oh, okay.
It's that kind of thing. It makes sense from a character perspective. It distances. So we're so connected with the Eric character. Like, that's kind of the audience's conduit into the movie, and we're supposed to feel what he's feeling.
Yeah.
So if we don't see his face, we don't make that connection between Eric and this space.
Yeah.
We're disconnected from it, and I think that's what the director wanted to do with that, and it works really, really well.
The other thing that amazes me about this film, the film's about 100 minutes, give or take a couple of minutes, actually, give.
Yeah.
So, the thing about it is, they got so much done in just the first few minutes. They established everything about this character in very little time, because you got to get moving.
Yeah.
And most films, when they do that, It just reeks of a rush job, short-sightedness. You know, we talked about this on other episodes. You know, just let the audience figure it out.
Right.
But they got every major plot point. I mean, yes, okay, it's kind of a basic plot point.
Well, on the surface. It's not a super deep movie as far as... Well, it's not a super complex movie, I should say.
Okay.
As far as, like, the plot.
Or complex, as Batman would say.
Right.
But it got where we needed to be in like record time without it seem like an MTV video, you know, like I just really appreciate that about this movie.
Yeah. You know? Because it opened with Sarah's narration over the miniature set that we now learned is a miniature and not CG.
Yeah.
Just talking about the legend of the crow. Then we cut to the crime scene after the thing has already happened.
Yeah.
We know he's dead. We know his fiance is gonna die.
They fill it all in with flashbacks.
We get Albrecht, we get Sarah, we get that connection between the two of them, we get the connection between them and Eric and Shelley, because it's obvious that Albrecht is, he's concerned. Like, you can tell, of course, Ernie Hudson, like, if you see him, we automatically connect with him, because he's such a great actor.
Yeah, we grew up on him.
Yeah, and he's that kind of person, that kind of actor who you immediately kind of latch onto, even if you hadn't seen him in things before.
And it makes sense that that character would be blacklisted, basically, in his own force.
Yeah.
Because he actually gives a shit. This is a city whose police department obviously gives no fucks about
exactly.
its town.
Exactly. And that's why you have the very stereotypical kind of detective who's like, get out of my crime scene, and you're just a beat cop. And he's that kind of guy. He's not like the chief of police is like turning your badge and your gun kind of, but he's that kind of character.
Yeah.
He's super stereotypical, but it works for this because he's not a main character and he's there. And again, that's another piece of the puzzle that you need for the movie. And it's in there in that opening scene.
Yeah. Because him caring so much about doing good and doing his job obviously cost him his marriage too.
Right. Yeah. And you see that because that's the thing where he's like, okay, move her. And the stupid cop detective is like,
asshole.
Well, I didn't tell you to move her. And he's like, so
judgment
you get that
call.
Connection, you get the clash between those two, you get that this guy cares, this guy doesn't. And this is all within the first, like you said,
first 5 minutes.
And then it's like cuts and then it's the movie actually starts
after off that. And running. Yeah,
so it's a great way. I hate movies that are all about exposition in the first act of the movie, and it's just so long just talking about all this stuff.
Yeah.
And if they had shot this movie in order, like chronological order, where you saw the attack happen at the beginning and then all that, it would have drawn it out way too much.
Yeah. I might have turned it off.
Yeah. Like, it's more powerful for you to see, for you to learn about what happened in the moment that Eric is getting his revenge.
Exactly. Yeah. I've seen movies that do it the other way.
Yeah.
And I don't even wind up watching those
movies. Yeah, I've seen tons of them. Like, I was thinking about it the other night when I was kind of preparing to like talk about this. I was like, I kind of like revenge movies. Like, a lot of movies I really like are revenge movies because they're simple plots usually, and you get it like pretty much right away.
Yeah.
But a lot of them do start with the incident and then they kind of move on to something else. And
that's a particular subgenre where you don't even need to understand what language is being said.
Right. Yeah.
That's a universal language.
Exactly. Yeah. So kind of, again, pivoting off that a little bit, talking about like the ease, the visual language of the movie, where you don't need talking and a lot of explaining to understand what's happening. I did want to talk a little bit about the editing in this movie, because I think it's really strong. Again, I think that's a lot of Alex Proyas's, even though he wasn't the editor, I think that's a lot of his influence on it.
Well, he seems like a director that actually goes to the editing office.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the way, like, because this did exist, this came out in the MTV generation, and this is around the time when all these really stylized like camera movements and crazy angles and lights and weird filters and like I remember a lot of fishbowl lenses, and I hate those, or fisheye lenses.
Yeah. And we're getting into the David Fincher era is David Fincher is the guy that is he's not the father of cinematic music video,
right?
But he's the most successful director to come from that.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. He
literally won, and I don't want to get too much on the David Fincher thing, but he literally was up against himself three times in the same category in the same year for video director.
Oh, yeah.
In the year 1990, I believe. Yeah. And that's how he got his movie deal. I was like, this guy makes the best commercials.
Yeah.
We should probably teach him to figure out how to make a movie.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I've seen some of those.
Yeah.
Actually saw some of those in some of my like film classes.
Nice.
But so this did exist in that time, and you get a little bit of that sense of that influence on this, because especially the flashbacks, like, they're colored red. There are a little bit of odd angles in those to kind of put you off a little bit, and the flashes, the white flashes and everything that happens. So there is a little bit of that. This movie is heavily influenced by the music that's in it, or vice versa. The music influences the movie.
It's heavy on the alternative.
Yeah.
And not just grunge, because I hate, you know, it's a stupid term.
Right.
But anything that is not mainstream, or that we had come to know as mainstream, college rock, The Cure, Joy Division by way of Nine Inch Nails, bands like that, even, you know, Stone Temple Pilots, Henry Rollins, Helmet, heavy bands that had something different to say than what we had been getting the last few years. So it's definitely, it's a sign of the times, but it's a good snapshot. It's one of the better snapshots of this era, for sure.
Yeah, I think, absolutely. And that's one of the things I was getting to with the editing, is even though that this exists in that time, and you can see that in this, it doesn't feel dated. If you watch a lot of movies from this era, they're kind of hard to watch sometimes because of how much in the music video style they were made.
Yeah, like the guy that played Tintin, he was in Hackers.
That's a good example of that. I love that movie. I think it's fantastic, and I'll watch it a lot because I love it. That was when I was just getting into computers and stuff. And I was like, Hackers, this is amazing. I want to do this.
But it's a 90-minute music
video. But this movie isn't so much. You can still watch it to this day, and it doesn't look dated. It feels kind of timeless. And I like some of the transitions between scenes. I like all of the transitions, actually. Some of them are kind of in your face. I remember one where it's like cut to the sound effect of like this, it feels like metal, like something hitting metal. It's like chung, chung, chung.
Yeah.
And it kind of pulls out and it gets to the next scene. But then there's other more subtle moments that are like match cuts, where one of the ones that always stands out to me is the first time you see the gang, well, not the first time, but when you see them in the pit, the bar, where they're all doing shots and they're downing the bullets and everything. Yeah. So Darla walks up, and Tintin, Lawrence Mason, guy from Hackers, at the end of that scene, Darla's talking to Funboy because they have a thing.
Yeah. Yes.
But Tintin is behind her.
Yeah.
And he, like, leans in and he, like, licks at her.
Yeah.
And, like, as he's doing that, the next cut, it cuts to a cockroach running across the ground. And then the crow goes and snatches the cockroach and eats it.
Yeah.
I think that is such a fantastic edit. That's one of my favorites because you make that connection, that flow, it flows perfectly. And you make that connection between, okay, this guy is scum and the crow is about to descend upon them.
That's good symbolism right there. I remember the shot you were talking about, but that other thing was lost on me.
I've always made that connection. There's really a few others in the movie like that.
Huh.
But I think that's one of my favorites, and that's one that always stands out to me.
All right.
And talking a little bit about the timelessness of the movie, I do think that that was also a very conscious decision on the part of the filmmakers. Because one of the things that Alex Proyas pointed out in the commentary is, like, the technology they use, the vinyl records and things like that, is a little bit out of time from the time that this was, because this was like CDs and there was technology was emerging at this time.
Yeah, there are no CDs in this film at all.
Yeah, so the music is all on vinyl, and part of that is because, like Alex Proyas said, he likes old technology. He likes wheels that turn, and he likes cranks and things like that. And you can see that in some of his movies, like Dark City. He did Dark City.
Yeah, yeah.
So you can kind of see that kind of pre-steampunkish kind of, in a way, you know?
Very good point. Very good point. I'm amazed at how much they made North Carolina look like Detroit.
Right.
I believe that to be Detroit. It's crazy.
Yeah, most of it's done on a soundstage, actually. Like, a lot of those sets are built.
Yeah, I can see the church for sure and the apartment. Yeah.
But even the streets, those are on a soundstage.
That's crazy.
And that's one of the things that was difficult because they wanted a car chase.
Yeah.
But their sets are on a soundstage. And they were saying that they couldn't really get the cars up to speed before they had to stop or they would have crashed into the walls.
So they use minis?
Yep. So, like, whenever there's a wide shot, that's a miniature. Alex Proyas was talking about how it was done out of necessity because that's all that they could do.
Yeah.
So those top-down shots are all miniatures, and it looks fantastic. Yeah. You can't really tell, but it does give that little bit of comic book styling to it at the same time.
All I can see is the side of the Death Star now, you know, just see that shot.
Even so, during that car chase sequence, Skank is in that little bitty car.
Yeah.
I love it when he gets hit by the car. He's like, "You asshead, you hit my car." Yeah. That's like one of my favorite lines. There's so many lines in this that I think or say, like, to this day, like, all the time.
Yeah.
But when the cop car hits, like, sideswipes his car, when they did that live, there wasn't as much of the sliding that Proyas wanted.
Yeah.
So he actually did more sliding in miniature, and that's part of what you see as the cars slide across the street. And then it cuts so well and it cuts so fast that it when the door opens and Skank falls out of it, you can't tell, you know.
Yeah, that was watched it just now.
Yeah.
Man.
So, like, half of that is miniature. And he kind of pointed out that, like, he was saying that he hadn't really seen it done before, but then a few years later in one of the Batman movies, he remembers seeing, like, those overhead shots, he remembers seeing shots very similar to what he did in The Crow on this actual movie set with actual cars full size.
Wow. So they influenced Christopher Nolan.
That's what he says.
Okay. I buy it.
Well, not Christopher Nolan, one of the other Batman movies.
Okay. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Oh, like one of the Schumachers.
But he's
he had all the money in the world, though.
Yeah, he did talk a little bit about some of the influence that his movie might have had on other things. But, and the helicopters?
Yeah.
Miniatures.
Wow. Yeah. Crazy. Like,
yeah, those when Eric is running across the rooftops, all the helicopter is a miniature.
Wow.
And the rooftops themselves, it's all built on a set, like all of it. So, it's pretty crazy. Like, knowing that and even watching it again, you can't really even tell.
No, and I'll forget it the next time. I'll get lost in it, you know, and then I'll think about it again later. So.
And little things, just a little bit more, the editing. One of my favorite things, of course, going back to the pawn shop scene at the end of that, when he pours the rings into the shotgun and he shoots it.
Great effect.
Yeah, Alex Proyas was talking about how he did that. He didn't actually shoot rings out of the shotgun.
Sure.
He did a shot where he had smoke and the camera was shooting up, directly up, and he dropped rings through the smoke so it went towards the camera. So he took that shot and put it at the end of the shot where Eric points and shoots the gun, And that's when you see the rings come towards the camera. That's actually him just dropping rings towards the camera.
Yeah, that's too good.
Yeah. So little things like that. I love hearing things like that.
Because that, I love that's practical. Better than anything that has ever come across Michael Bay's brain.
Yeah.
Telling you.
Because he knew what he wanted to do, and he found a way to do it practically, yeah, for the most part.
I pick on Bay because he's an easy target. It's like Nickelback, yeah, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that kind of covers a lot of it, but I just love how stylized this movie is. And again, the black and white, the rain was obviously symbolic because you see a lot of rain and you see a lot of fire in this movie. The rain is white, the fire is red or orange, and so it fits with the palette, but it also fits with that clashing of two things. But it also helps to bleach out any color that does kind of get through, and all the steam and everything, it all kind of serves that purpose.
Wow.
So we've talked about the physical making of the movie up to this point.
Which I thought was going to bore me, but it was actually really cool stuff. I'm not saying anything about you. I'm making up stuff. I'm just like out to lunch, you know. Right. But, you know, I'll watch the special features if I really want to know.
Because I love that stuff. And I think Alex Proyas, at this point, he actually didn't do a whole lot after this. I mean, he's done some things here and there. But this movie in particular, to me, it's obvious when someone connects with the material that they're trying to make. And he obviously did.
I wonder if that's why he doesn't have like this huge, you know, resume in a sense of it's got to be damaging to anybody that's been on that set mentally. Yeah. And, you know, also maybe he's like, man, I don't know if I could ever do it that good ever again.
Right.
I totally, whatever. Maybe it's a combination of those two things, but I get it, man.
Yeah, it could be because like we talked about the plot of this movie, we haven't really talked about the story so much. Are going through the plot because it is pretty simple. It's a revenge movie, but I think
going up the rung.
Yeah,
literally, that's just going up the ladder.
Yeah,
getting the underlings,
and it's very episodic. Like the comic book is super episodic. Like it's actually there's titles for each.
I imagine that each kill is probably a separate volume.
Yeah, they're all kind of different segments. He would release maybe a few pages in some magazine, and then eventually he released like. The first three issues, if I have the big collected volume of it, Kitchen Sink Press released the entire story in one volume back in like 94, somewhere either right before or right around the time the movie came out. But before that, there are three highly collectible comics that I'd love to get my hands on, but they are just the first three parts of the story, but he never got it finished at that point. It wasn't until the collected volume came out. Yeah. But long story short, they're titled, and you were talking about the t-shirt that I was wearing, like those, the words on the back, those are titles from the different pieces of the comic. And so it is like each set piece that you see in the movie is kind of like each one of those segments from the comic book.
Do you remember if in the comic book that the kill order was the same as the movie? I'm curious about that.
I don't think it was.
Okay, because
I can't remember.
Well, the reason I'm asking is this ties back into the film.
Yeah.
This kind of had to be pointed out to me.
Mm.
But on the IMDb trivia track, somebody pointed out that the kill order of the underlings were an intended rape of Shelley order.
Were they?
Yeah, because 1010's going to go first. Fun Boy pushes him out of the way, and then he goes first. But 1010 was going to be first.
Yeah, yeah.
But everybody, he actually kills in that order in the movie. And I was like, that's really cool.
Well, yeah.
So I was just curious, the comic versus movie thing. Just like it is book versus movie.
Yeah.
You know, there's liberties taken. But whoever's choice that was, like whether it was the first intended thing by James Abar or if that was Proyas' choice, that's a fine attention to detail that I appreciate because I'm a chronological order man myself.
Yeah.
And that's how I would have done it.
Right. I was trying to, I can't remember. I think 1010 was first to go. Okay. I can't remember when Top Dollar got it in the comic. I kind of don't think he was last.
Yeah. And can you tell me a little bit of background? I'm glad you kind of brought that up about the difference there with Top Dollar not being the big bad.
Mm.
There's the guy that Michael Berryman, he got cut out of the movie altogether. Yes. I love Michael Berryman. So why isn't he in this film, Chris?
Okay, so there are differences from the comic and the movie. Really big differences as far as the mythology. Like in the comic, there's no mythology of the crow. Like that whole thing where you kill the crow, you kill the man.
Really?
That doesn't exist.
Wow.
It's not there. In the comic book, Eric can't be killed. He doesn't heal. Like in the movie, the bullet wounds heal and the blood disappears, which is always weird to me.
Yeah.
But his wounds heal. In the comic, if he gets shot, he gets shot. The wound is there. He has to tape himself up.
Wow.
It's not
like Jason.
Yeah. It doesn't kill him, but he sees the wound. He collects wounds. And
okay.
So, but the character that Michael Berryman was to play in the movie was called the Skull Cowboy. And in the movie, he was supposed to be a kind of a harbinger. It's kind of confusing, and I'm glad they dropped it from the movie.
Okay.
Because what his role was to inform Eric that by helping people other than, or by helping anyone actually, like his purpose was to kill these people, get revenge for what they did to you,
sure.
Then you go back to the afterlife.
Okay.
When he helps Darla, when he like makes the morphine fall out of her arm,
yeah,
that is helping. That's not his mission. That's not what he's there for.
Oh.
So the Skull Cowboy was there to basically say, hey, you can't do that. If you do that, your powers are going to go away.
Wow.
And so when he goes at the end of the movie,
that's going to, that'd be hard for the film. Yeah.
So
the audience too.
Yeah. When Sarah gets kidnapped by Top Dollar and his friends at the end of the movie and they go to the church, there's that scene. You see a big wide shot of the front of the church with the words above the church, demolished by neglect, which I love that so much.
Yeah, that's always stuck
with me.
Yeah.
But the Skull Cowboy was to appear there, and he was basically telling Eric, if you go in there, if you try to save this girl, I can't help you anymore. If you get shot, you are going to die, and it's going to be terrible. And so that was his purpose in the movie.
Huh.
They shot a little bit of it, and you can see clips in the Blu-ray release. There's an edited footage montage. Okay. There's not, the scene isn't there because I don't think they shot enough to make a full scene.
Okay.
But he did. He was in full makeup, full costume.
Huh.
And they shot at least some images of him, so you can see him in that. There are pictures. You can find pictures online too.
Okay.
But
that's in the book too, right?
Yeah. That's where I first learned about it.
Who is this book? Who wrote this book? Just in case people want to look it up. It's called The Crow, the Movie.
Jeff Connor and Robert Zuckerman.
Okay.
But, yeah. It was released by the same company Kitchen Sink that released the comics.
Okay.
But in the comic book, the Skull Cowboy only appears like once or twice, and he doesn't do that. That isn't in the comic. It's not, there's no story about, there's no subplot of if you help people then your powers go away, because it wasn't really powers. He was just a guy, and he couldn't be killed. The end.
So the intention of the character is he's kind of like a metaphysical enforcer for the balance of the world, almost.
Yeah,
like
kind of.
He's like kind of like the Grim Reaper. Like, he's not a bad guy, he's not a good guy, but he's going to tell you how it is.
He's informing. He's the exposition character, explaining it to the audience.
Okay.
Yeah. So I'm glad
I would need that explained to me for sure.
Because adding that character complicates the movie much.
Yeah.
Because it's so much better and it's so much simpler, because you can see throughout the movie the connection that Eric has to the bird, because they see through each other's eyes. The crow sees Tintin at the beginning.
Yeah.
Eric knows where Tintin is. You get that connection without having to say anything.
Yeah, and I think if they had added the Skull Cowboy in there, and not that Eric wasn't above help, because he did take help at some points during the movie, especially from Ernie Hudson.
Yeah.
But I think it emasculates him having this other guy kind of hover over him a little bit.
Well,
and I think it would hurt his character as far as being the anti-hero that he is.
I would agree with that, because it complicates things, and it's too comic booky. Eric is undead, but if you see this Skull Cowboy who's basically looks kind of like a zombie with a cowboy hat, it's like it's gonna pull you out of the movie, because up to this point you know it's not real, but you get that sense of reality. A lot of that has to do with Brandon's performance, because he grounds this character that can't possibly exist in a world that is too stylized to ever exist anywhere, but he grounds him in reality. But if you add the Skull Cowboy, who I love Michael Berryman, but he's gigantic, and he's gonna be this thing that's so weird and out of place. And that final scene in the church, on the script, I think it was where Eric, of course, he loses his powers to an extent. Top Dollar and Micah and Grange were always supposed to think that it was because of the crow, and in the way the movie was released, it is because of the crow, the bird. But in the original script, it was because Eric was helping other people, because he was helping Sarah, but Top Dollar and Micah didn't know that. And so it was this weird, confusing thing. They just got lucky. Yeah, they just lucked into it.
Yeah.
So it was a subplot that didn't need to exist and complicated things for everybody.
Gotcha.
Right. So, yeah, that's why he was cut out.
Wow, okay. Yeah, so it wasn't such a bad choice after all. Yeah,
but in the comic, there's one of the, I can only remember, like, one really main sequence where the Skull Cowboy is, and it's kind of a dream sequence. There's a lot of kind of dream-like sequences. You're not sure if they're real or not.
Gotcha.
And I think it's Eric is, like, on a train or something, and he sees a horse, like, running through a field next to the train. And it's just a few images on, it's just meant to give you kind of this feeling more than anything else. It's not, I don't think it's supposed to be.
Oh, so it's like a, happening. Huh,
yeah.
Kind of
thing. Okay. But the horse is running alongside him and he kind of makes a connection with this beautiful animal that's running alongside him.
Yeah.
And the horse runs into barbed wire and it gets caught and there's blood and everything.
Wow.
And then you turn and you see the Skull Cowboy, who is mostly just a skull with a cowboy hat. He's not like a zombie.
I saw the photos finally. Yeah. You showed me before you went on air, and I said it actually kind of looks like the judge from The Frighteners.
Yeah, he does, yeah. But in the comic, he's just like a skull with a cowboy, or a skeleton with like a cowboy hat on, and the crow is sitting like either on the Skull Cowboy's shoulder or something, and the crow says something. I don't remember the words exactly.
Nevermore.
But it's,
I had to do it. Hey, he referenced it first. I know, I'm not the asshole here.
But he says something to Eric, and I can't remember what it is. Something about, like, not connecting with the real world or something. Or something to the effect of the sequence is supposed to be, like,
Stay out of it.
There's no good things for you anymore.
Okay.
Like, this isn't what you're here for. But it's more of just, it's kind of an aside. It's not part of the plot of the loose plot of even the comic book, so...
Yeah, that makes it a two-hour-plus movie.
Yeah, so, yeah, I'm glad that was kind of excised. There is another scene...
But they could have done all that
and
made maybe a good sequel if they just had to do it.
Yeah.
Why not? Because that would have been way better than the shit that they did.
Yeah, but I'm glad that they never made any sequels with Eric. I know that...
Well, yeah, yeah.
Even if Brandon had lived, I wouldn't have really...
I don't think he would have done it either.
Yeah, I don't think he would have.
I don't think... They didn't approach this as a franchise.
No. And that's one of the things that Porius was talking about in the commentary, is that they never intended for this to be a franchise. They weren't...
With like, what, three sequels and a TV series?
Yeah.
Get about it.
Yeah, but...
Shame on all of them.
Yeah.
Shame on them.
But there is one other sequence that was cut that you can see in, I believe it's the Blu-ray release, and it has to do with kind of what we're talking about. In the sequence in Funboy's room, after he helps Darla and she runs away, or changes her mind, basically, and she runs away, Funboy, he actually gets up out of the tub on his own.
Oh.
And when Eric turns around and he's looking at the syringe where the drugs are in.
Yeah.
In that same shot, you see Funboy run out of the bathroom towards him, and there's a fight scene between the two of them. And this was all shot, but they dropped it partly because they dropped the whole subplot of him being injured because of helping other people.
Okay.
Because in this sequence, Funboy actually slashes Eric pretty badly with a razor, and he's bleeding and it's not healing.
Oh.
And so if you notice after that sequence, there's cuts in Eric's jacket. There's a huge one on the back. And after that sequence, that's when you see the black tape on his arms for the first time.
Oh, geez. Okay.
Yeah, because his wounds don't heal, so he has to tape them up.
Yeah. And there's so many reshoots already at this point. Yeah. It's like, you know, I'll just leave it.
So there was, there was a lot of stuff that was
I can forgive that.
Yeah, there was a lot of stuff that was cut from, that they had shot some of it, but some of it was just cut from the script. That I think makes the movie better because it makes the plot simpler. It doesn't confuse things with all these things that you don't need. And it focuses on, instead of plot, it focuses on the character. And I think that's one of the things that really brings this whole movie together. If you hadn't had the cast that they had for this movie, I don't think it would have worked even nearly at all as well. It would have just been kind of a typical 90s movie that looked pretty cool.
Especially for 90s and to a certain extent 80s.
Yeah.
I think this has some of the all-time best character actors of all time in one setting. It's so cool. Matter of fact, Chris.
Yes.
I hope you don't mind. I prepared something in advance.
Okay, have you?
6 degrees of Joey.
All right.
I'm going to give you a really quick one here. Maybe a little bonus lightning round because I'm going to see if you can name off the actors real quick. I'm going to name my 6 personal favorite films that are tied into cast members from The Crow.
Okay.
And this is my insertion. Some of these are not typical of something we might review on this podcast.
But okay.
Just do a quick one. For the people out there, if you haven't seen these movies, please see these movies. I'm assuming by making this list, you've already seen Ghostbusters, Ghostbusters 2, and Candyman for Tony Todd. So I'm leaving those off, so don't send me any hate mail. So my personal six from 1 degree of separation to 6 degrees of Joey.
Sure.
I'll have a name for it at some point. So, starting off with Big Lebowski.
Oh, yeah. Gideon.
The pawn shop.
Yeah.
John Polito.
John Polito, yeah.
He's like a Coen Brothers guy.
He's almost one of those guys that you see in like all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. Tons of stuff. Tons of television, whatever. Yeah. But yeah, Big Lebowski, of course.
Yeah.
And I know that that's a popular movie with a huge, massive cult following, for lack of a better term. But I don't think right off the bat you'd be like, oh, that's the guy from Big Lebowski, which is why I put it on this list.
Nice.
Next movie, Talk Radio. That's one of my personal favorite Oliver Stone movies.
Yeah.
I could have also said The Doors, because this guy's also in this movie as well, but so I'm kind of a, this is kind of the Oliver Stone entry for The Crow. If it's been a while, and I'll forgive you if it has, Michael Wincott.
That's what I was thinking.
He plays a punk rock metalhead kind of guy who calls up the studio and he gets invited down and he just interviews this kid, and it's like such a train wreck interview, but it's such a funny scene. So if you want to see Top Dollar sing a Megadeth song at the top of his lungs, then make sure you watch Talk Radio. Next one, Bad Boys. Not the Sean Penn one, even though I do love that movie.
Yeah.
But the Martin Lawrence, Will Smith movie. I love Bad Boys, not so much Bad Boys 2. Sorry, Edgar Wright. Bad Boys 1 is a better movie. And the actor or actress involved would be someone who's in my next entry.
Okay.
Probably my favorite film of all time. If you put a gun to my head, I have to name this film. I think you know what it is, Chris. What is it?
Adventures of Fort Fairlane.
That's one of them.
Okay.
And that's also on my list.
All right.
But I was going for True Romance.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. And so that and Bad Boys, you get... See, this is why I'm good at Kevin Bacon. This is my one true strong suit.
Yeah, sure.
Anna Levine, who was the mom... The morphine-addicted mom. She's in both Bad Boys and True Romance. She rejects Christian Slater at the beginning of True Romance, and you never see her again because, she winds up not going to the movie with him, forever altering his life.
I remember that now. Okay. Yeah.
And it was about the same time, within a year of each other, 93 and 94. And Anna is also the secretary in Bad Boys, who actually moves the plot along towards the last act.
Oh, wow. I don't remember that.
She's an important part of the film.
It's been so long since I've seen that movie.
It seems like a thankless role until she becomes important.
Right.
So another reason to watch that movie. And the last two are for the same actor. You already said Adventures of Ford Fairlane. I think you know where I'm going with the second one, Chris. So who's my Adventures of Ford Fairlane actor in The Crow?
David Patrick Kelly.
Yes.
Yes.
And what is really, truly his most famous role?
The Warriors?
Yes.
Okay. Oh, I didn't know you were going to go there. Yeah.
Yeah. So my top six, Big Lebowski, Talk Radio, Bad Boys, True Romance, Adventures of Ford Fairlane. And yes, I do love that film. And The Warriors. And thank you, IMDb, because this is the greatest trivia track thing I think I've ever seen, ever.
Oh, really?
Brandon Lee was apparently such a fan of the Warriors and was so happy that David was in this film.
Mm-hmm.
Did you notice how he paid homage to him even while interacting with him in the movie? It's very subtle, but since I happened to have read it right before the big scene between T-Bird and Eric Draven, when he sends the car off on its way into the river.
Yeah, he does a little wave.
He actually puts his two fingers together
and
waves like he's clanging glass bottles.
I forgot it. Yeah, now that you mention it, because I always thought the wave was kind of funny. But now that you mention it,
that's exactly 100% for real why he did it that way.
That's awesome.
Because he's saying, come out and play.
That is very cool.
I only got one other thing to contribute to this, Chris. What's your favorite song on the soundtrack? The soundtrack is great, by the way.
It's difficult. I bought the soundtrack and the score, and I've listened to them countless times. And I like a lot of them. A lot of it has to do with where they happen in the movie, I think, because it kind of imprints it on me. And when I hear the song, I think of that part of the movie. Yeah,
that's what any good entry in a soundtrack should do.
So for a while, it might have been the After the Flesh by the My Life with the Thrill Kill Cult, because playing when they go into the club right before the big fight scene. It was for a while Dead Souls, but I think it's Burn. I think it's the Cure song.
Oh, wow.
It's my favorite song on that soundtrack.
Yeah. I actually heard that they brought someone I know went to go see him on their tour last year.
Yeah.
They brought that out for the first time live because they had so many requests for it.
Oh, really?
So The Cure actually did play Burn live. I'm sure there's YouTube clips of it out there. And mine is Dead Souls. Nice. If I could tie it into a Rock Strikes 10 episode, on a very early episode, I did a show called The Replacement Covers. Songs that, in my opinion, where the cover versions are actually better than the originals. I truly believe in my heart of hearts that Nine Inch Nails' version of Joy Division's Dead Souls is just, it just blows away the original, in my opinion. Yeah, sure. Not a big Joy Division fan. You can send me hate mail for that. I've given them plenty of chances.
Right.
But that version is so powerful. Trent Reznor just hit a home run with it. And the live version is great, too. Go seek that out. So that's what I got. Thank you for giving me a couple of minutes here. I'll give you the $5 later.
No worries. I think, it's good because we were talking about the characters and we talked about the music a little bit and how much it moves the story along as much as anything else. Talking about the editing earlier, the music is such a huge part of the movie, and me talking about how I hear these songs on the radio or wherever I hear them, and I think about the scenes where it happened. I think about T-Bird and his gang driving in the hot rod that he has, and
the Big Empty's playing. Yeah,
Big Empty is playing, and so I always think of that. I don't think of the music. I don't think of Stone Temple Pilots anymore. I think of The Crow with that. Right. And of course, like everything in there, but the heart of the movie that we've kind of talked about a little bit with your 6 degrees is really the amazing actors in this movie.
Yeah.
And we talked about how Rochelle Davis, who played Sarah, was very good in what she had to do.
Yeah, she could have had a great career.
Yeah. And we've talked about Ernie Hudson a little bit, but you dig deeper into that. You talked about the John Polito, who is that guy that you see in that movie, all the time. But he's so good, and I love the character of Gideon so much. And it's little things that just, when I watch him in that pawn shop scene, like, I think is one of the best. And you see him freaking out, and then when Eric points the gun at him, when he does, just the looks that he gives towards Brandon in that scene, it's just the little things, and it's all of these characters and actors do it.
Even the bartender's good. Like, they're all good, man. Like, he's that, he gives just enough of a shit to be a good bartender.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of doesn't give a shit, but he kind of does.
He's so snarky, too.
Yeah, things like that. And also, I've talked about this a lot with you, Chris, over the years. Do you think that Bai Ling knows that she was in this film?
I was going to get to her. Like,
I contest that she has that persona.
Yeah.
And, we love her.
Yeah.
But I always feel like she's just a bystander that wanders onto the set every single movie she's in.
Funny answer is no. But real answer is, I've heard her in interviews talk about getting onto this movie because this is one of her first, at least American movies.
Yeah, big. She was pretty much doing like Hong Kong films before all
and
this,
she,
right?
She was talking about like when she walked in to do the read for the audition, she never thought she was going to get it. She felt so out of place with all these like, because a lot of the actors
that we talked about.
Well, and the actresses that were up for that were reading for the role as well, she just felt so out of place there. But that's probably a little bit of what attracted Proyas to hiring her for this role, because I mean, if you put Michael Wincott and Bai Ling next to each other, and you say brother and sister, you would react like Gideon did. And he's like, you're supposed to be brother and sister?
Yeah, great, like, chemistry.
Yeah, but they work so well together, and it's that thing. And that's one of the things that I love about this movie and these characters, is they do all work so well together. You only see T-Bird and Skank in a few scenes together, really, but you get that connection between the two of them, and you get the hierarchy of when he's like, get in there, like smokes and road beers. You get that thing.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the guy that plays Skank Angel David in much beyond that, but he's so good in this role. Yeah. So.
And of course, Tony Todd's always great in anything he does.
He adds that weight to this role because it's not a very big role. It's very much a support role in both what he does as the character in the movie, but what he brings to the movie as well.
Yeah. I'm going to get you to some sort of horror con or sci con at some point, because I guarantee you I can get a picture with you together with Ernie Hudson, Bai Ling, and Tony Todd.
That would be crazy, yeah.
How great would that be?
But so talking of like the actors, they all brought something to this movie, and watching some of the interviews with Tony Todd talking about this movie, is he didn't necessarily get the character right away. He wasn't feeling what he should be doing in this character until, you know, the little thing that he wears on his pinky.
Yeah.
He said he found that and he was like, okay, like, when he put that on, he kind of got what this character is. And I don't know exactly how that works because I'm not an actor. Because
the character kind of has no feelings, but that's the point.
Yeah. But it, I think it shows how invested even these people that weren't in these lead roles are so good at what they do, and they're bringing all of this depth of experience for the most part. And even the people that aren't, like Bai Ling and Rochelle Davis, are bringing just raw energy to the set with these experienced actors, and it all comes together to create what, again, would have been a average movie if these people weren't in it.
Agreed.
I think a lot of it has to do with what Brandon brought. Everybody that I hear talk about Brandon Lee is like, this guy is the greatest, was the greatest person in the world. He was so nice to everybody. But he's also one of those, he was an artist. Like, his dad, Bruce Lee, of course, he was a martial artist who got into acting.
Yeah.
Brandon Lee was an actor. He learned the martial arts because he's Bruce Lee's son.
Yeah.
And
he wanted to be like his dad, but to a certain extent.
Yeah, but he wanted to act. And of course, he was put into...
And if he was a martial artist, he would have gotten typecasted.
Right.
Just like his dad did.
Yeah, and...
And well, we love him, but...
And that... because of his name, because he's Bruce Lee's son, he's going to be typecasted unless he can do something. So he has to work... It's almost like one of those things where you have to work even harder to get respect for what you want to do.
It's like a comedy guy breaking into drama.
Yeah. So. And... Like, the first movie I remember seeing Brandon Lee in was Rapid Fire.
Okay.
And it was fun, but it was him kicking things and punching things.
Yeah.
And then I saw Showdown in Little Tokyo with him and Tia Carrere and Dolph Lundgren, and I love the movie, and one of the things I love about it, the action's good, but Brandon Lee is amazing in it. He's this goofball comedy character in this movie. I wouldn't say goofball.
Sure.
But he brings... Dolph Lundgren is the straight guy.
I was going to say, like, and, Dolph has to be the straight guy.
And Brandon is the cop that wisecracks and, like, is doing all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and, you know, I got to say, Chris, I'm finally going to make this right. Over the years, you've told me about how much you love that movie. So, and I've still... I'm going to right the wrong. I've never seen it. So I promise you I will watch it.
Okay.
But to make
I did a surprise reaction. My head went back a little bit when you said that.
Yeah, so... get ready for even more of a surprise.
Okay.
This is really off the cuff. I had this hidden in the studio. Not for the purpose of the show, but I just was trying to remember to give this to you. So on air, Chris, I'm gifting you a Laserdisc copy of Showdown in Little Tokyo. You see That's awesome.
Yes.
So there you go.
Definitely posting a picture of this.
Yeah. You know, obviously, I doubt you have a Laserdisc player at this point, but, you know, that's going to be a great frame job, I think.
I'll buy one to watch this on Laserdisc.
Okay.
That's amazing.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, hey, man. It's nothing.
All right. Cool.
He would have been the man. Like, he...
Yeah.
Imagine how many big franchise roles he'd have taken from some of these guys. And maybe that wasn't his bag. Maybe he would have been like... as I like to say, and I'm not trying to knock... present output of these guys, maybe a little, but like early Brad Pitt, middle era Brad Pitt, early Johnny Depp, like he definitely would have been in that conversation when those kind of films came up.
Yeah, and that's
the true tragedy of
it. Because it was always intended to be his breakout role, because he had done the typecasting, the Bruce Lee's son. He was Bruce Lee's son up to this point, and that's the kind of movies that he was in.
Yeah, and he was he was going to be a Joey Travolta.
Right.
Even though those guys are brothers.
Yeah.
Like, he'd have been Frank Stallone, Joey Travolta. Yeah. Like, those guys. Like, and I know he saw that going on, and it's just, it's a death.
Yeah, man. And he knew it, but we talked about, like, the script of this movie isn't deep, but he took what was given to him, and you can tell in every scene in this movie, he takes this character and he embodies this character. And it shows that like I talked about Tony Todd finding how to be this character through this little thing. It's like, that's what these actors do in these situations. Michael Wincott, he was insistent upon having the long hair, because they were like, you can't do that. It's going to take too long, because that was all like hair pieces that they had to do like every single day.
Right.
He was like, no, I can't be this character without it.
Yeah.
And Brandon, he was rising, I wouldn't say above that level, but he was right in there with them with this movie. Yeah. You see the close-ups on Brandon in this movie, and you can just see it in his face. Like, he is this character, and he's so good. And he's in almost every scene in this movie, And a lot of the times he's one-on-one with these actors who have been doing this for years and years.
Yeah.
And he's pulling these performances out of these people. The pawn shop with Gideon. Yeah. I think a lot of that dynamic has to do with the fact that Brandon was so good and he was so invested in this role
yeah.
that he helped pull that out of John Polito.
And I all think a lot scenes... of those guys would tell you that, yeah. too. If, I feel like they would.
And the scenes with Ernie Hudson, especially like the apartment or in Albrecht's house when yeah. he walks into the house and when he... We haven't even talked about that plot yeah, point that, where he pulls the visions out of the yeah. head and how yeah. that kind of works all the way through the movie. Mm-hmm. That wasn't in the comics at all.
Gotcha.
But Ernie Hudson had said that the end of that scene where Eric is sitting on the floor and he sees the picture of Albrecht and his fiance. Wife, who is... They're getting a divorce, is what he says.
Oh, yeah.
That was all improvised. That was Brandon. Like, they were doing this scene, and from that point on, Brandon just kind of... That's what he did. He...
So most of the dialogue, when he's sitting down on the floor like that, that's improv?
That's what Ernie Hudson said, yeah. Wow. He said, like, he's the one that went in that direction, and Ernie, the professional actor that he is, of course, like, yeah. he was in that moment as well, and Brandon pulled him into that yeah. moment, and they were able to keep going with that, and that's how that scene ended.
Wow, so that whole trivial line.
Yeah.
Wow.
And so that adds so much to the character that, yeah. like, up to that point, you had gotten a little bit of... You could see how they were connected through their empathy for people. But then when you hear that Albrecht has going through a divorce, and you see Brandon actually kind of showing a little bit of compassion
yeah.
to this guy who he really doesn't owe anything to. They don't yeah. owe anything to yeah. either each other.
Yeah.
But you get... so much more from both characters in that little bitty thing.
Huh.
But it's just those things, and it's... I hate for this movie to be remembered as the movie that Brandon Lee died in.
Yeah.
Because this movie was always intended to be his movie, and it should be, and it should be remembered as the best performance of this young actor's life.
You know? Yeah. If it had been in more modern times, like today...
Yeah.
Like, you know, and it bears resemblance kind of to the Heath Ledger thing.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, yeah.
I mean, Heath got nominated for that. I feel like in this time, they might have actually, you know, given yeah. him that nom.
I think
and
so.
That wouldn't yeah. have been, that definitely wasn't a reality at that point.
Right.
But, you know, he definitely was worthy of it even at that time, is yeah. what I'm saying. But, you know. It's, you know, those things have kind of changed over the years, you know.
Yeah, I think so, because this was a comic book movie, and it was a violent movie, and the violence was actually a lot more than what we saw.
30-plus body count.
Yeah.
And that's just mostly the boardroom alone, right? You know, so, yeah.
And the final scene with Top Dollar falling off the roof of the church and hitting the gargoyle and the blood coming out of it, yeah. which doesn't make a lot of sense, but it looks really cool to have all the blood
yeah.
come out.
Yeah.
I remember like Alex Proyas had said that used to be a lot more. You saw Top Dollar actually falling onto it, and you saw the whole thing. And,
yeah, because you only hear it in the yeah. movie. You think you see it, but you don't because of the way yeah. you see the aftermath. We yeah. talked about that a lot in the Friday the 13th yeah. movies, yeah.
But he was talking about each time they would go into the editing room, they would cut a few frames out of that until they got to the point where you see a little bit of the blood at the bottom of the screen, and then yeah. it kind of pull and pans up a little bit.
Yeah. They're probably like, screw it, yeah. just leave it out.
But then, like you were saying, in modern times, that would be different because you see an Edgar Wright movie, you watch Hot Fuzz,
yeah,
and that's gory.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, so there's a place for that at this point.
Yeah, also having to do with the church.
Yeah, exactly. yeah. yeah, that's probably why I thought of that immediately. But, yeah, so I think this movie, I would be lying if I said that I didn't connect to it because of the emotion that... is involved with that, because I was a fan of Brandon Lee before this movie.
Yeah.
And
a lot of people can't say that, honestly. Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't long before it, but I had seen some of his movies before, and this is around the time when I was really getting into like kung fu movies, and of course Bruce Lee was the first martial arts actor yeah. that I really got into. This yeah. is before I discovered Jackie Chan and Jet Li and everything.
Sure. But you know, Bruce is he's the Elvis Presley of, yeah. of kung fu
so
actors.
He's probably yeah. I mean, I know he's the gateway to
yeah.
most Westerners for kung fu movies, and he was for me, and I was super absorbed with him prior to this, and then I started seeing some of Brandon's movies, so there's that emotion to it. So when I watch this movie and you see the end of it, when you hear that final narration by Sarah, it's like, I don't really, you can tell that it's not just about the movie at that point anymore. It's about Brandon as well. And I love the way that this movie ends with Eric going to the grave, and you know he has to go back to the grave.
Yeah.
And you see Shelley walk up to him, and they kiss, and then he disappears. You don't see him go back to the grave. You don't see him dead.
Yeah.
He's gone. To me, like, when I watch this movie, the overall plot of the movie of Eric coming out of the grave, being here for this, in the movie, it's about 2 days, a little bit less, I think.
Yeah, yeah.
That, to me, feels like the fact that we got to see this movie and that they finished it and did release it, to me, it feels a little bit like that's where you can hold on to that memory of Brandon Lee, because it's like the narration at the end is, if you love someone, if you remember them, they're not dead. No. So when I watch this movie, I remember what he was. And at the end of the movie, he goes back and he's gone until I pick up that DVD or Blu-ray again.
Yeah. Wow.
That's what that means to me.
There is no possible way I could ever say that better myself. So let's just get out of here, man. We've had a good night here. So just stay tuned. The Last Theater on the Left. It's on cnjradio.com. We'll see everybody on the next one.
Bye.
Safest place in the world to be.
It's because everybody's dead.
It's really late, Sarah.
You didn't say goodbye.
You're just gonna have to forgive me for that.
It's okay.